You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Although, like everyone else, I'm not doing a whole lot of that these days. Joining us on today's show to continue talking about C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy is Dr. David Grubbs. David, once again, I failed to get your title. You're at Houston Baptist University. You're a professor of English and live in Houston. With your wife and kids. What else do I need by way of introduction there? Despite listening to your podcast every week, I can never remember all of these details.
Assistant professor.
There we go.
So you know, being precise there. But other than that, you know, you stuck the landing.
Good job. Awesome. There we go.
Even the Russian judge is reluctantly.
Well, I tipped him a 20, so you know. Also joining us today is Jordan Poss, who has helpfully written all of this down for me this time. So thank you for that, Jordan. Instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina, and this says recording from the comfort of Fountain Inn, South Carolina. I know where Greenwood is, or maybe I know where Greenville is, and I'm just assuming that I know where Greenwood is. I have no idea where Fountain Inn, South Carolina is.
Greenwood is almost an hour exactly, like, directly south of Greenville, and about an hour northeast of Augusta. Greenwood is a fine town. I don't mean this derogatorily. It is kind of in the middle of nowhere. Fountain Inn is about 20 or 30 minutes outside of Greenville proper, sort of on the way to Columbia. So I have about a 50-minute commute, or I had about a 50-minute commute. Which is why I said I'm in comfort now, because I'm in my Clemson t-shirt in my own office library at home, not having driven anywhere today.
I know that by saying Clemson, you've just divided the listenership into two separate camps. Although I don't know what those camps are, because Southern sports isn't really my bag. But
well, it is insular enough that I reached farther into adulthood than I should have, knowing that the rival of Clemson is USC, and I don't mean Southern California.
Yeah, I follow Mountain West sports, and we don't bother anyone. So yeah. we're always competitive, and we never win. So that's a good place to be, I think.
Yeah. Everybody pats you on the back at the end and says, "Good game."
They always have to work for it, but they always win. So.
Y'all are those teams that my mom would describe as consistent.
Yes.
I learned the word consistent from my mom when she described Atlanta Braves shortstop Jeff Blauser as consistent when I was a kid.
Consistent.
He's not going to go into the Hall of Fame, but he's good.
I'm tempted to go down the college sports rabbit hole here, but we shouldn't.
Well, I've just used up everything I have, so.
No. I hope to do an episode on college sports someday, because I deeply love it and deeply hate it at the same time, and there is nothing more fun than going to a Division I sporting event of whatever kind, and nothing worse for the university than
yes.
But that's, again, a conversation for a different time.
Well, I could get on board with that.
I guess we've probably had enough banter at the beginning. But the question that I had for you guys is in 30 seconds or less, what is your quarantine reading? What are you reading while on lockdown?
Now, you've written like 5 novels already, right, Jordan?
Yeah.
I work. Not quite at a Tolkien pace, but it's close to glacial. I did do a complete read through of my latest manuscript and mark it up. I have not started making those changes yet.
glaciers are consistent.
Yeah. let me see. What have I read so far? Well, Out of the Silent Planet. Every night before bed, I read a little bit to Sarah, and we've been reading the Rumpole stories, which I don't know if you're familiar with those. He's a criminal defense attorney in Britain, and they are very, very funny. I finished a collection of those. I reread Gringos by Charles Portis, who is awesome. And if you haven't read Charles Portis, you need to. And Gringos is really, really good. The Language of the American South by Cleanth Brooks, which is a collection of lectures from Mercer University. I listened to Moonraker, read by Bill Nye, which was awesome. He's a really fantastic reader. I read the first two Boxcar Children books to my kids. Reread On Old Age by Cicero. Read The Scarlet Plague by Jack London, which is a apocalyptic novel about a pandemic that I had never heard of before. And it is like the granddaddy of the first 30 minutes of every zombie movie. Like, you know, society descending into chaos and small groups of survivors. It's actually really, really good. I enjoyed it. Progress in Religion. I mentioned that on our episode of Out of the Silent Planet by Christopher Dawson. A collection of essays by Plutarch. Quintus Cicero's Guide to Electioneering. And Paralandra, and I'm currently reading Sappho for an episode I'm going to record tomorrow for core curriculum. How to Think Seriously About the Planet by the late, great Roger Scruton. The Smallest Minority by Kevin Williamson. Lord of the World by Robert Hugh Benson. And a couple of other books I've got around here somewhere that I can't remember. It's too much.
Yeah, I don't think either of us are going to beat that. David, what do you got going on?
I am prepping for a World Epics class in the fall.
Awesome.
And so I'm working my way through the Persian Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, the Ramayana, the Finnish Kalevala, the Chinese Romance of Three Kingdoms, and the Argonautica.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Argonautica is fantastic. Of all of those, that's the one I've read.
It's a lot of fun.
I did a paper on that, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, just kind of by circumstance, and it's probably the most fun I've had writing a paper.
That's cool. Yeah, it's the book that I never understood. I can't understand why nobody assigned me to read it.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess I should follow that with, I don't know when there was a readable translation available, because I feel like the one that I used for my paper was somewhat recent. I'd have to go back and look specifically, but in the last 15 or 20 years.
There's very recent Penguin one that is in poetry called Jason and the Argonauts, but the one I'm reading is called The Voyage of the Argo, and it is a prose translation also by Penguin.
Okay.
Yeah, the poetic one I read, I actually read in the emergency room with one of my kids a few years ago. It is really good.
Well, there you go, listener. If you're looking for something to read other than C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, there are several options for you. We should get into the trilogy. We're today talking about Paralandra, which has moved us from science fiction. C.S. Lewis has kind of kicked that to the curb, I don't even know what genre to put this in, but before we talk about that, we should talk about context. Jordan, can you tell us a little bit about this book, where it comes from, what's going on when he writes it, what's happened up until this point between, you know, after Out of the Silent Planet and so on?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll be bringing up H.G. Wells or Edgar Rice Burroughs much today.
Right.
Paralandra is, it couldn't have happened. Lewis kind of says at the beginning that it's sort of meant as a standalone novel. I don't know how much sense it would make to a person who hasn't read Out of the Silent Planet, honestly, but, you know, he at least tried to make it standalone, and it is, if you've read Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra is it does what a good sequel does in being different enough not simply to repeat the first book, right? This is not Die Hard 2.
Well, no, it's far better than that.
Yeah.
Die Hard 2 is terrible.
Yeah, no, no naked William Sadler Tai Chi. Although you do get Naked Ransom for most of the book, which it gets mentioned in passing. Anyway, the big thing, it was striking to me, having read these before, how much more polished this one is than Out of the Silent Planet. As much as I like Out of the Silent Planet, and I really do enjoy it, he is clearly, I think I said in the last episode, he was kind of getting his fictional feet underneath him in Out of the Silent Planet. He has clearly found his feet, and there are, I don't want to say the whole book, but there are in very gripping episodes in Paralandra, I think. I feel like maybe it, we'll talk about what happens at the end here later, but it is considerably more polished and has a lot more drive, and he also experiments with it a little bit more structurally, where Out of the Silent Planet ends with this passage about, you know, knowing Ransom, and, you know, kind of Ransom sort of correcting some of what, you know, Lewis, the fictional Lewis, has put into this account, which, you know, things that he left out in summarizing Ransom's story. Here you actually get the beginning being a recollection by Lewis of actually going and meeting Ransom as these events are unfolding. So he's actually kind of inverted some of the structure of Out of the Silent Planet, which is interesting. But this is published in 1943, if I remember correctly. And between the publication of Out of the Silent Planet in 38 and the publication of Paralandra 5 years later, he's worked on a bunch more books. Again, World War II has broken out. He has not only begun contributing, you know, what we would probably call op-eds to newspapers, which requires him to communicate clearly and succinctly, which I think is where Lewis brings his A game out. Because in one of his letters, Tolkien talks about how, at least before all of this, Lewis was occasionally given to kind of like, I think the adjective Tolkien used was kind of creaky. He's much more refined, much more polished. He's also working like a beast, just turning out stuff. So in 1940, he publishes The Problem of Pain. 1942, he brings Lee a collection of print versions of some of his BBC radio talks that will eventually turn into Mere Christianity. And if you're interested in that whole textual history, there's a good book about that by George Marsden. He also brings out A Preface to Paradise Lost and The Screwtape Letters, one fiction, one nonfiction. Both of which I think are crazy relevant to Paralandra. The fact that he's working on all three of these things at the same time, I think there's a lot of cross-pollination. The context, though, in which this book is written, the setting of the story is in 1942, at least I think that's the date, which is given explicitly near the end of the book. At that point, the United States has just gotten involved in the war, but the outcome is still very, very doubtful, especially for the British, who have been in privation thanks to things like the Battle of the Atlantic, which, you know, the U-boat wars interdicting supplies coming from elsewhere in the world, which is where the Nazis almost win in Europe. So that's I think an important part of the context of the story. And again, he had worked on it for a while before publishing it. Lewis could work very, very fast, but he did revisit things quite a lot. And again, I dipped into Tolkien's letters to look for him talking about Paralandra. Apparently Lewis had shopped this around at the Inklings quite a bit for a while before actually bringing it out, and Tolkien actually liked this even better than the first book, and as we'll probably talk about next time, he had rather strong opinions about That Hideous Strength, which he thought kind of ruined the trilogy. So I've got in the notes, just riffing on this, I included, you know, one of the old SAT analogies. That Hideous Strength is to Paralandra as The Return of the Jedi is to The Empire Strikes Back. I think. Oh, good deal. So that makes sense to more than just me. So, I mean, it's, you know, perfectly passed, doesn't actually do anything to improve or conclude the trilogy on a high note. the first lines of the book are a lie. We'll get there in a minute. Anyway, that's. I think the historical context in which Lewis is working, and the fact that he is working so much, particularly in fields that require very clear, concise communication, improve Paralandra quite a lot over the sort of experiment of Out of the Silent Planet. What would y'all add to that? I already see you again, Coyle. You've got a note about this coming up.
Do I? Sorry, what note do I have?
The first lines of the book are a lie.
Oh, yeah. So if we're done with the background, he has a preface, which I guess maybe this isn't in every edition, but my edition has a preface that says, story can be read by itself, but is also a sequel to Out of the Silent Planet, in which some account was given of Ransom's adventures in Mars, or as its inhabitants call it, Malacandra. And then this is the lie. All the human characters in this book are purely fictitious, and none of them is allegorical. I assume the two-sided meaning for that is that, on the one hand, he wrote that for Tolkien, because Tolkien apparently hated allegory. And then on the other hand, I assume what he means there is what's going on in the book Paralandra is not an allegory for World War II, right? It's not supposed to be a picture of, you know, the Nazis and the Allies fighting it out between Weston and Ransom on Venus. But it is obviously an allegory, and it is equally obvious that Ransom is Tolkien. So I think that's just a kind of a bald-faced lie with something that he is trying to convey in that. But yeah, that's so I when I was rereading this, I read that and I was like, oh, hey, wait, this is not true at all. Why would he start with that? And then thought a little more, is like, oh, World War II and so on. Yeah. David, do you want to give us just a quick overview of the summary? I like the little one you gave us before we started recording, but you are free to expand that if you want to.
Sure. Though I think I will disagree with you in the fullness of time about whether or not this is allegory.
Sure.
I want to remember to disagree.
Sure.
So finger on that.
I'll put that in the notes so we don't forget.
Sweet. I think my memories of our last episode are vague. That was weeks ago, and much of life has been happening since then. But I think I remember describing Out of the Silent Planet as a long walk and a series of conversations in order to get to a long conversation. This is this is a long swim and a series of conversations in order to get to a fist fight.
And another conversation.
But. And then another conversation. Okay. Yeah, so Ransom, our protagonist, our hero of Out of the Silent Planet, because of the adventures he has in Out of the Silent Planet, he is now part of the he's sort of the initiate from Earth. He's the one who knows about the reality that exists beyond our silent planet. He now understands the system of you know, the solar system. He understands, you know, there are beings on other planets. They are watched over by these sort of planetary angelic intelligences called Eldil. There is a creator over all of it. So Ransom is pulled into the really the politics of this larger world. And so our nameless narrator, who I guess is Lewis, is going to meet Ransom at the beginning of the book, and then assists him on beginning his second journey, which involves lying down naked in a coffin, which then flies away. And then the coffin returns years later, or months later, or whatever, can't remember the time. He opens it up, and it's full of roses, and there's the same guy with a long beard. And then the novel is what happens in between. In this one, Ransom goes not to Mars, but to Venus. What he finds out is Venus, which is a sort of a imagined as this ocean planet, with all of these islands of floating weed that have developed ecosystems. They've got, you know, trees and forests and all the rest of it, but it's not growing on flat ground. It's growing on this flexible this flexible matted vegetation that actually ripples with the waves. And so C.S. Lewis spends a lot of time meditating on Ransom's obsession with this ever-changing landscape. What we are used to being permanent on Earth, because it is built on stone and all the rest of it, is not on Paralandra. You'll have this series of, you know, rippling foothills like, I don't know, a moor or something. And then all of a sudden, it's not that anymore. Anyway, there's a lot of description in the book. The heart of the matter is that sentient life or gnaw life on Paralandra is just beginning. And Ransom encounters a beautiful green woman who is, he eventually finds out, the very first ensouled, intelligent woman on Earth. She is on Paralandra. She is the queen, and somewhere is the king, and they got separated, and she's looking for him. Then out of, well, I was going to say left field, but actually out of the Silent Planet, comes that round spaceship that we remember from the first one with Weston, the scientist, who is now no longer the sort of jingoist Earth scientist who just wants humanity to be saved, and has now become, gosh, we're going to have to talk about what he's become, but it's freaky and also the devil. Like, literally, actually, the devil. He's pretty much possessed. So what we get is this redux of the temptation of Eve, except this time it's not a serpent. It's an Earthman who is the voice of the evil one attempting to lure the woman into sin, into violating the prohibition. And unlike Eden in Genesis 3, this new Eden on Venus has someone on the other side present with her, a redeemed man who actually knows the fullness of God's plan for dealing with sin and suffering and death. So this is not just Genesis 3 all over again, because in Lewis's universe, it really does make a difference that Maladel took on the form of the fleshly Hnal of the Silent Planet and suffered and died and rose. It really does matter in his universe that this is after the coming of Christ and the rising and glorification, ascent and reign of Christ. All right. So this Genesis is going to work differently. So there's a long series of conversations in which Ransom attempts to counter the temptations of Weston. We'll probably go into some of that. Satan's tactics this time around have a very different flavor than Genesis 3. The lures that he offers to her are different in subtle ways. In the end, the resolution is not, as you might have expected, for Ransom to be sort of a good C.S. Lewis proxy and just with, you know, good British common sense, talk Eve out of it with his BBC Mere Christianity voice. That I found fascinating because I'd forgotten it. In the end, he can't actually defeat the evil one with mere words and mere arguments. It becomes a fist fight. And over a long extended period of time, a naked guy and a raggedy demon-possessed man just brawl across the landscape. Eventually, Ransom wins, and in the process, he smashes the head of the evil one while his own heel at some point in the process is bitten by the evil one. So, yeah, I guess the first lines of the book are a lie. Yeah. And in the end, the queen finds the king. They are restored to one another. They are enthroned as beings who have passed the test, right? And they receive the kind of glorification of a tested, tried, and true being that humanity did not get because they fell. And so in the end, we have this image of all the beasts, all of Paralandra gathered around in the king and queen, including their planet's intelligence, bowing to them as the images of Maladil in that world, ruling it as is their right. We have some theology, and then Ransom gets back into his flying coffin and goes back home. And they get very, very close to some conversations where I really wanted them to talk more, but they keep getting distracted.
Right. Someone invariably says, "I'm tired and I'm going to sleep now."
Yeah. They're like right on the edge. I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. Say more about that, Lewis. And she's like, oh, no, they went to sleep. Oh.
Who doesn't wish that you could just say, "I'm tired now"?
This conversation's over.
Yeah. Like Forrest Gump. I think I'll go home now.
So, that's my plot summary. A long series of conversations that ends in a fist fight, and is followed by more conversations and singing.
Well, anything else? I don't remember there being any major. I think you hit all of the sort of big points. Any other plot points? Otherwise, we should jump into some of the text.
I think that's got the plot covered. I mean, anything else we would talk about would be unpacking what's really going on.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Jordan, you have a list of memory joggers in our outline here. nice. You want to jump on any of those?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I was telling y'all before we started recording, I listened to the Out of the Silent Planet podcast and was like, oh my gosh, I didn't say anything I got on there intending to say. And I was clearly really tired and a little out of my head, at least to me. So I made sure to have ample notes to remind me of things that I was thinking of as I read, particularly influences. And I think as I was talking about earlier, something that sets Paralandra apart, especially from Out of the Silent Planet, which is, again, basically a riff on H.G. Wells tropes, with, again, a few other kind of things thrown into the stew, like we talked about, and especially from that Hideous Strength, which is its own other thing entirely, is Lewis has reached a maturity as a fiction writer where he is not just repurposing stuff he likes, he is riffing, right? He's mastered the material to the point where he's just kind of like throwing in things, creating something completely new out of repurposed parts, right? Not just repurposed. Again, he's not just, you know, doing the fanfic thing of like, you know, it's a gender swap Lemiz or whatever. you spend enough time in the self-published world and you see everything. So the pieces that I see swimming around in here, the big obvious one is Paradise Lost, right? Because Ransom has become kind of a fly on the wall to the temptation of Eve, and goes from simply fretting about it and trying to argue to actively doing something about it, which is where he kind of departs from that. But again, having written a preface to Paradise Lost at like exactly the same time, in the same context, in the middle of everything else that's going on, that's clearly a major influence here. The second kind of half of the book has always, and from the first time I read it, reminded me a lot of Dante, both Inferno and Purgatorio, but especially Purgatorio, because the fight against Weston, or the thing in Weston's body, Eventually takes them underground. They fight through a series of subterranean caverns. They just like brutally maul each other. It's like the end of Terminator, where every time you think Weston is done, he comes back in just worse and worse shape. I mean, the last time he appears, it really reminded me of that, where, you know, by that point, Ransom is just utterly exhausted and done. But you get this real attention to the perverting effects of sin, right? Like in Inferno, where everything that Weston interacts with is corrupted, and it begins to do that work on Ransom as well. And we could talk about kind of Weston's vandalism, especially his cruelty to the creatures of Perelandra. But then you get, following Weston's defeat, this kind of, this is the part that reminded me so much of Purgatorio, a climb up the mountain, you know, out. It's like the final couple of lines of Inferno, when Dante and Virgil have descended past Lucifer and have inverted and are now climbing out the other side of the world through this cavern, following a trail of water, right, to get to the surface. And it's this climb both out of a cavern and up a mountain, which is not salvific, right, because they're already saved, right? Purgatory is the realm of the people who are blessed. It's sanctifying. Once he comes out on top, this is where the comparison. As much as I love Dante, the pageants at the top of Mount Purgatory, you get to the top of the mountain in Perelandra, and there's a very, very, very long series of kind of like enactments, you know, of physical embodiments of metaphysical truths, right? These pageants that are unfolded for the good of the observers, and that's very much something that you see in Purgatorio, which, again, the last several cantos of that take place in the earthly paradise, the Garden of Eden, which has been removed to the top of Mount Purgatory. Other parts that are floating around in there, there's a passage where, following his combat with Weston, Ransom tumbles out of the cave into a pool and is just kind of nourished by the water and by the sunlight of Perelandra and by the fruit that are available there, which is very similar to the kind of unending cycle of combat where the Red Cross Knight experiences in the Fairy Queen, and he is also healed in similar circumstances to go back to fight again. And all of this is that chivalric stuff that Lewis was just steeped in, right? I went through some of his books and some of his letters looking particularly for references to Parzival, the continuation of Chrétien de Troyes' Percival, Arthurian romance. I found one offhand remark about the author Wolfram von Eschenbach in one late letter where he simply referred to him and Chrétien as men of genius. So he is clearly familiar with and admires this work, and that came to mind because when Ransom arrives in Perelandra, because he's been flying in one direction for an indeterminate amount of time, naked in this glass coffin, the sun tans him unevenly all over his body, so he's got like dark and pale patches, which causes the queen to refer to him as piebald for most of the course of the story. And there are a number of characters who pop up like that in chivalric romance, and maybe the most prominent is a guy named Fyderfitz in Parzival, who is Percival's half-brother by his father. He's pagan, he's a Moor. But he is what we would now call biracial, but he's got patches of light and dark skin, and he's kind of a noble creature, a noble man of an in-between state where he's partially pure and partially impure, which I think maps on to Ransom's role in Perelandra pretty closely. Yeah. I don't know how much of this is intentional, but I think that's somewhere in there. And because Lewis has mastered this so well, he can, again, riff on it as will. And maybe my favorite thing, one offhand remark about the Battle of Maldon, early in the fight against Weston, when Ransom is not utterly exhausted and he's kind of filled with the sort of joy of combat before it becomes just a slog, before it becomes a battle of attrition, he says he actually finds himself singing lines from the Battle of Maldon, and that has to be a speech right at the end of the poem by a retainer named Birkwald. Battle of Maldon is a fragmentary epic about a battle against the Vikings in the year 991, just for context. And there's a very famous speech by a warrior named Birkwald, who is in a desperate, probably fatal fight, but reassures himself and his comrades by saying, "Mind must be firmer, heart more fierce, courage the greater as our strength wanes." Right, which is a really famous passage of Anglo-Saxon poetry, probably also a bone thrown to Tolkien. Right, all of which again is just kind of not thrown in there. It's very, very carefully crafted, but again, it's not a pastiche. It's not like Star Wars where you can say, "Oh, that's Buck Rogers, that's Akira Kurosawa, that's a Western," that kind of thing. It is very, very. It is its own coherent thing, which is an accomplishment when Perelandra works so well artistically. We'll talk about pacing maybe later, especially with the pageants at the end. But again, all of this is going in there, and I'm recognizing a lot more of it now, you know, 12 years after having initially read it. Would y'all add anything to that? Can y'all see anything else? Anything that, I don't know, maybe I've just cooked up while I've been reading it.
I'll defer to you, David. I know little about that medieval literature stuff.
Well, we have it might seem that we've left Edgar Rice Burroughs behind, but this whole being transported naked to the planet and spending your whole time without clothes on. That's pretty Barsoomian.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, still there for sure. Yeah.
So I
overstated that, sorry.
Yeah, no. It's science. It's a different flavor. It's not spaceships and all the rest of it. It's rather transport to another planet by means of some mystic, who knows how you would describe this. There's even, if I'm remembering the end of Princess of Mars rightly, there's the, was it Princess of Mars? What's the one where, John Carter is actually entombed?
Yeah, right? That's in, Princess of Mars.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I kept thinking of that. That the coffin is his means of transport. I kept thinking of that image. I like that you brought up the piebald Firefitz from Parzival. I hadn't remembered him, but the imagery works. Like even if Parzival is not in the background of Ransom as piebald, still that image of a character who has this combination of natures, this inconsistent combination of natures. I mean, that is Ransom's struggle through all of this, is that he is not wholly possessed by good in the way that the queen is, nor is he wholly given over to the evil one. He's able to kind of stand between both and feel the pull of both, but not fully embrace the perspective of either. I think the reference to Inferno is helpful too. I was thinking about this as you were talking, Jordan, that the evil one in Weston, it's pretty clear over the course of time that he is possessed by the fallen Oyarsa of Tholkandra, Satan, basically. So that it's just Satan trying to do again what he'd done, you know, in Genesis 3. But as time progresses, Ransom comes to realize how shallow, vapid, in a way, this Satan is. He has a cunning, he has an excellence of speech. But if you push him, you realize how shallow he is as a person, how small his desires are, how little his self-understanding is. And that's very much like the souls that you encounter in Inferno, who are trapped in the perversity of their sin and literally are no longer able to learn their lesson and be better.
Right.
They are the souls who now believe the lies that they told to justify themselves. And there's something in the way that he's that the evil one is presented in Paralandra that reminds me a lot of Dante's meditation on the evil of the damned.
Yeah. And how kind of childish is not quite the right word. I think Lewis uses the word childish at one point, but I mean, you know, the devils in Dante's Inferno crack jokes and fart at each other, and you know, they just kind of like poking the sinners and hurting them for fun, and even Satan himself never speaks in Inferno. He just sits there and kind of gnashes on Brutus and Cassius and Judas the whole time, because he is so consumed with rage and that kind of, I guess the word I'm looking for is spite. Just the sheer spitefulness that comes out of Weston to the point of childish mind games. Strikes me as pretty Dantean. And I meant to bring this up too. I mean, that's exactly the image of the devil that you get in the Screwtape Letters, which again, he's writing about the same time. Again, just, you know, nothing is too low. Nothing is too spiteful. I was going to save this for the end. I've actually got, if you can find it, there is a version of the Screwtape Letters that includes a 1961 preface that Lewis wrote about 20 years later, again, shortly before he died. And it's got, he compared the qualities of literary depictions of angels and demons, blah, blah, blah. I'll get to the, I really enjoy this whole preface, especially because he makes fun of Victorian angels. He says, in scripture, the visitation of an angel is always alarming. It has to begin by saying, fear not. The Victorian angel looks as if it were going to say, they're there. anyway, so he has this to say, which I think does have some relevance, especially because Ransom brings up one of these in the course of the narrative. So Lewis says, again, 1961, looking back at Screwtape Letters, the literary symbols are more dangerous because they are not so easily recognized as symbolical. Those of Dante are the best. Before his angels, we sink in awe. His devils, in their rage, spite, and obscenity, are far more like what the reality must be than anything in Milton. Milton's devils, by their grandeur and high poetry, have done great harm, and his angels owe too much to Homer and Raphael. But the really pernicious image is Goethe's Mephistopheles. It is Faust, not he, who really exhibits the ruthless, sleepless, unsmiling concentration upon self, which is the mark of hell. The humorous, civilized, sensible, adaptable Mephistopheles has helped to strengthen the illusion that evil is liberating. And again, Lewis, in the voice of Ransom, explicitly name drops Mephistopheles at one point because he is so flummoxed initially by what Weston, what this thing in Weston is like. He was expecting Mephistopheles. Instead, again, he gets this really nasty seventh grader.
I think he uses the word petty at one point when he's when the Weston creature is killing animals. Like when everyone else is sleeping, Weston is out killing animals and carving up trees and doing just kind of dumb, small-minded stuff just for the purpose of destroying something.
Right.
Yeah. I remember when I hit that reference to Malden Jordan, I figured like it's got to be that.
Yeah.
it had to be Bickle's speech. But there's a few different places I didn't highlight them, but you know, there are a number of places where Ransom draws upon his literary knowledge in order to make sense of things. It becomes a resource for him. And that's one of them. And it reminds me of, that reminds me too of Dante, of the way that, not everything that teaches Dante in Purgatorio, for example, that teaches those in Purgatory is an image from the Bible or from Revelation. They also have images from classical history and from Greek myth, and the ways that human art, human literature, human endeavor, human history becomes a resource for even a higher redeemed achievement. And so Ransom here is, in order to accomplish his task, he doesn't have to stop being who he is as a result of his life, his education on Earth. He doesn't have to stop being that. The best of those things that he learned on Earth become the things that equip him for this other task. And so it's a kind of a Christian humanism. This is an interplanetary Christian humanist hero.
Awesome.
Fighting the devil, not just with, you know, main force and, you know, theological acumen, but also with, you know, with Dante and Milton and, you know, the unnamed poet of Malden.
Which I think makes Weston a good counterpoint to that. But anything else on the medieval references, Ransom's character, etc., before we get to the bad guy?
No, sorry, I didn't mean to waylay it that much, but I think it does, I mean, as I think we've illustrated, it does offer at least some insight into what he's doing, what he's up to, that he took these ingredients and kind of made something wholly new, but
yeah,
I think a lot richer than Out of the Silent Planet, out of it.
Yeah.
Right, instead of just throwing all the ingredients in and mixing them, he actually cooked it for a while and mixed them, made it a little better, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if Ransom is kind of this embodiment of the best of culture, and of course he's a Christian. I mean, that's the main thing. But Weston, I think, is interesting. He, based on the things Weston says, he goes through a sort of transition through the book. So when Ransom first meets Weston, he helps him unload the spaceship, and they sort of chat while they're doing that and setting up Weston's camp. At this point, I think Ransom doesn't know that he is possessed, and I don't know if we're supposed to assume that he is actually talking to the person Weston, or if this is just another kind of deception that the demon is putting forward. But basically, what Weston is saying is the sort of thing we would read in Hegel. So it's civilization, mankind is moving forward, which we got some of that in Out of the Silent Planet. But Weston has had a sort of spiritual experience. He's in modern terms, we'd say he's become kind of a New Ager, where he says all of that stuff. He basically says, look, all of that stuff that I thought was true, I was wrong about, because I forgot that I didn't think about there's a spiritual world. So it's basically the same words, but being used to talk about spirituality instead of just material science and the physical expansion of humanity. Now it's the development of man towards spirit, which again is, I mean, that's phenomenology of mind, and that's
Geist.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Lewis specifically had that word in mind. So it's now where the human race is marching towards this Geist moment. And then if we jump forward a little bit in the book, when Weston, or with the Weston creature again, it's never really clear who's doing the talking. Sometimes there are times when it's very clear that it is the demon, and then there are times when it's kind of unclear whether it's Weston or some combination of the two. When he's actively trying to tempt the lady, when he's actively trying to convince her to rebel, I guess we should say the specific injunction that she's not to break is the command is she is not to stay overnight on the fixed land. There is an island that doesn't move. So her version of don't eat the fruit is don't stay on this island overnight. So Weston is now trying to convince her that you need to stay on this island overnight. So if you sort of read the speeches he gives her and the arguments he gives her, he's moved from being Hegel to being Nietzsche. So you show your greatness, you show your greatest obedience when you rebel, right? When you stand up and become your own person and sort of rise above the common, petty, everyday stuff of life, and show your true greatness by living authentically for yourself, all of those kind of buzzwords that we would get if we were to sit down and read Beyond Good and Evil or the Antichrist or any of the Nietzschean writings would work here. And then Weston goes through yet another change, but I want to stop before we get to the last change. Thoughts, anything to add on Weston up until that point?
When you called him a New Ager, that was it just felt so prescient. I know that he's pulling on these older resources of Hegel and Nietzsche, but in the way that he said it, it was a stark reminder of how much the language of the New Age movement grows out of late 19th century, first half of the 20th century resources.
Sure. I mean, all of those cults are running around now, right? I mean, it's the Theosophical Society and the Seventh-day Adventists. I mean, everything that's going to shape the 1960s in terms of its religious language is already in place.
Yeah. The Christian Scientists and Theosophists and
all that Madame Blavatsky stuff.
Sure.
The Western obsession with a sort of sanitized versions of Buddhism and Hinduism, that obsession with ancient Egyptian lore, which is through this kind of hermetic lens, all of that stuff is there. Like, you know, he could be talking to Aleister Crowley as well as Nietzsche. Right.
Yeah. Sure.
So, yeah, it was just really fascinating to me the degree to which the way that Weston talks sounds so familiar and so much like things that I've heard soberly said in my lifetime.
I mean, especially where Weston or the demon. And I don't know how much we want to get into this, but he begins to make kind of, I don't know what the right word is for it. He begins to make appeals to the queen or the lady on the basis of her gender role, which sounds very much, some of his arguments sound very much like kind of the modern arguments of sexual liberation, where, you know, instead of a unity of the king and the queen, Weston begins appealing to her to seek this kind of autonomy and independence that is going to fracture this relationship before it's even gotten started.
Yeah.
Which also felt very, very prescient.
Yeah. I had wanted us to come back to this, but maybe we can talk about it now. It's interesting. Lewis is writing about the nature of temptation of an unfallen being. That is by definition something that we can't understand, right? That is beyond our experience, and will be beyond our experience, you know, prior to the return of Christ, I suppose. So it's something that's super difficult to get our minds around, and I don't think Lewis has done a worse job of it than anyone else. I think it's just one of those things that, I mean, it's never going to be satisfying. So what, if I understood this right, his takeaway was that the lady's imagination was tainted, but she didn't fall. So. Sort of like when he was talking in Out of the Silent Planet, Mars was externally attacked. So the devil, the rebellious being, destroyed the surface of Mars. So they dug these trenches, and now everyone lives in the trenches. The same kind of attack was made on the lady, where her imagination was sort of scratched up by this demon. But unlike Earth, she didn't give in to the temptation. Sorry, spoiler alert, listener. I guess we've already spoiled the end. So her imagination is soiled with these images that have been put in it by this creature, but her will never assents. Her reason and her will and her desires are never corrupted. And it's an interesting way to talk about it. I don't know that I necessarily think of the imagination as something external to us that can be corrupted while the rest of us aren't, but I suppose you have to have something to say. You have to.
Yeah.
Well, it's the how do you gain the wisdom to the kind of wisdom that permits you to imagine what the thing that should not be is without desiring it.
Right.
And that's the wisdom that she attains.
Right. And again, that's either that's nonsense or it's something that we will never understand because we're fallen beings. And I suspect it might be nonsense, but I don't know. and Lewis has some, I forget if it's Mere Christianity or God in the Dock or one of his other books, he talks about the temptation of Christ. And the example he uses is how when we're tempted, when we're tempted and we don't give in, the temptation increases, right? Because then we haven't satisfied that temptation, so then we just want it more. And when Christ was tempted, Hebrews, I think, talks about how he was tempted more than anyone else. Well, that's because he never gave in, so that external temptation just got greater and greater and greater and greater on him in a way that it never does with us, because we always have our breaking point. And I think I understand what Lewis is saying, and I think that's a really useful apologetic point. I'm not completely sold on it theologically. In part because when I'm tempted, when someone comes to me and says, "Hey, let's go rob a bank," I'm going to say no. But there's always going to be a part of me that's like, you know, I do kind of want to rob a bank. That does sound like it would be both fun and good for me. And I think an unfallen being, whether we're talking about Christ the lady on Venus or even the gardener, whatever, doesn't have that little internal voice saying, yes, this is fun, I want to do this, I do desire to rob a bank, which again puts them outside of our experience and outside of our understanding.
Yeah. I don't know, I didn't, oh, go ahead.
She's a perfectly rational being, right?
Sure.
Which means when he's presenting these, when the evil one is presenting these images before her, she analyzes each of them and is like, why would I want that? I have this. Why would that be desirable? I have this other thing which is given to me, which is more desirable. Like, what? She doesn't feel the attraction of it.
Right.
And so you can kind of see what would it be like to have to tempt an unfallen being into falling. You would have to be able to rationally persuade them that this thing, that this other thing ought to be desirable.
Yeah, and I thought he did a good job of that, like especially the frustrations of both Ransom and Weston trying to find vocabularies with which to communicate to her about these ideas.
Right.
Weston to try to find a way in, which in keeping with the nature of the devil that we see in Dante and elsewhere, Tolkien, right? He can only take the pre-existing good vocabulary and pervert it and twist it and try to spin it in a particular light that makes it look, you know, more good than the goodness that she knows. Where Lewis is, or Ransom, excuse me, is also struggling to find vocabularies. And I think it's interesting that at the very end of the book, he talks about suddenly finding a word for evil that he didn't even remember learning at some point, you know, in the old solar language. Like, suddenly, only after the temptation has passed, does that language actually have a word to describe this thing, which is no longer a temptation. So I took the temptation of the lady as not necessarily tainting her, but kind of like leading her again in a kind of perverted rationality toward a position where Weston could kind of make his final assault. And then that assault having failed, the danger has passed. I don't know how well I expressed that, but yeah, it butts up against some pretty incomprehensible theory, stuff that we can never know for sure, at least not in this life.
Right. And again, I'm not meaning to crack on Lewis for this, because I come away unsatisfied when I read about it in Augustine. I come away unsatisfied when I read about it in Edwards. I mean, this is just one of those things that we're on the other side of that, and yeah. Both experientially and because Scripture is not written for unfallen people, like
right.
It's
right.
It's just not something that I don't think we can ever really get our mind around.
I guess for the purposes of fiction, it just has to be convincing, and I found it fairly convincing, especially since, you know, basically all we get in Genesis is "hath God said," right? So this is kind of a multi-chapter elaboration upon whatever kernel of the story we've got there.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Well, and this whole time he is mulling over the logic and the plausibility, the believability of Milton's version of mm-hmm. this.
Right.
And he is also writing A Problem of Pain, and he is also writing the Screwtape Letters. So this idea of what is the nature of temptation, and what might it be like to be tempted but never fall, you know, all of these things are in his mind. I find it so fascinating that he I'd never looked at the timeline of that to see that he's working on all these other things, and it just works so perfectly, Jordan, when you laid that out, like these are the things that he's writing. But for in the end, there is no mere Christianity. There is no final essay. There is no, you know, sort of Chestertonian paradox that he drops like a bomb and the evil one like goes whimpering off. You know, in the end, he just has to punch him till he stops. And there's something really viscerally satisfying about that,
mm-hmm.
because the evil one is not a creature of logic. He uses the forms of reason. He uses the outer mantle of rhetoric in order to accomplish his purpose. And if you're only fighting him with more words, he can always come back with more words, because he's not bound by your logic. Like, mm-hmm. you know, your arguments don't counter him. He's just going to go off and come back with something different.
He's an internet troll.
Yeah, he's just a troll.
Well, and you're not going to win anyway, right? He's better at logic than we are.
Yeah. And he's been around a lot longer.
Right.
So in the end, you just have to ban the serpent.
And
ban the troll.
that had to have been sad. I remember I had kind of the same thoughts there, and I remember reading this and thinking this has to have been satisfying to write, because you know that Lewis was picturing other faculty members when he was writing this. He was thinking, we have hit the point where civilized discourse can take us no farther, and now I'm just gonna have to beat your face in and
with a brick in the name of God in England.
Yep. Yep.
for St. George.
That's great.
So we've all had those thoughts, and I suspect many of our listeners have had them about me, and that's you know, you're not alone in that.
That moment where Ransom feels righteous wrath, it's actually one of my favorite moments in the novel, where he goes into this fight with a sense of narrative inevitability. Oh, well, I guess this is what it's going to have to be.
Right.
He's not
like a condemned prisoner. Yeah.
Yeah. But at a certain point in the fight, he commits himself to it, and he is filled with this enormous rage at this creature, which in the way that Lewis describes it, it is cleansing. It is it's a good angry.
Right.
Right. And, you know, I've never felt that unadulterated, pure rage against something that legitimately just needs to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never felt that. But to imagine what is the right use of rage? What is the right use of anger? To narratively imagine that, I think is one of the more interesting parts in this book for me.
Definitely.
To be angry instead of not.
Certainly, unlike I don't know the medieval literature well enough, but it's certainly unlike any of the classical literature where you have those battle scenes where someone has their as we talked about in the Iliad, you know, someone has their aristia, where they just go in fists flying yeah. or spears flying or whatever, mm-hmm. and wail on the other side. It is both not that, because it's Lewis is very clear. This is two kind of middle-aged academics, and nothing more than that. There are no superpowers in this. These guys are just kind of not old men, but middle-aged men who don't know how to fight, wailing on each other. and it's not a blind rage, right? It's not possession by the god or anything like that. Maybe there are analogs in medieval literature, but this is not out of the Iliad, right? Or this is not out of the Aeneid.
I don't know. I think there's maybe there's no possession by a god. There's no blind rage, but I think maybe the aristia, there's kind of a sudden, I'm just spitballing here. I mean, there's like a sudden purity of action that happens when that moment comes.
Sure.
That maybe there's a little bit of that here, but yeah, it is of a different species, even if it's within the same genus.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't have that that annoying / wonderful interruption of Homer of, you know, your hero's in the middle of his aristia, he's kicking butt, he's taking names, but every time a body hits the ground, Homer just insists on reminding you who's going to miss this guy because he doesn't come home.
Right.
Like, this is a battle scene where you can give yourself over to that joy of battle.
I mean, to be fair, Weston's pretty unpleasant. Maybe just no one's going to miss him.
Maybe he's got like one grad assistant who's going to.
Yeah.
He's got all this research that he's gathered, and now he doesn't have anything.
Right,
to do
he's
with
not going
to
sign off on my dissertation now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good he's already dead, isn't he? Like, Weston's already gone by the time the fight happens, right?
I don't know. Like Coyle said, it's really hard to tell because there are moments where it seems like maybe the devil doesn't actually depart, but he lets Weston come to the surface long enough to evoke Ransom's pity, because for Satan, pity is a flaw. Pity is, you know, that's
Smeagol-like. That is,
there is something very Smeagol-like about the way, especially toward the end of the fish chase scene, where they're just kind of floating together in the ocean, and Weston is as evil as he is, and despite what he has attempted to do on Perelandra, he's genuinely pathetic.
Yeah, and that's
for
the
for a minute
after the dolphin race, right? That's I did want to get to the kind of the last stage of Weston, and again, whether it's Weston or the demon just isn't clear, but he in his last moments moves from Nietzsche to Lovecraft. Right, where it's basically all of the stuff he was saying to the lady, right, but with anything even remotely appealing stripped out of it. The universe is just kind of a thin skin of physical reality stretched over this this horrific abyss, and he's seen down into the bottom of it, and he knows that there is nothing good there, and everything that's coming is awful, it is both kind of pathetic and sad and horrifying all at the same time. Which does kind of, I think, raise questions about Lewis's killing him in the end, right? If that's where, I mean, he kills him a couple of times. Because he beats his face in with a stone at one point, but then he also chucks him off a cliff, And I think he strangles him at one point. I mean, again, I'm not yeah. exactly clear what we're supposed to do with all of that. But the end of Weston, the last big speech he gives, really is kind of a Lovecraftian description of the world. And I don't know if we're supposed to take away with, like, this is outside of Christianity, this is the view of everyone, or if this is yet another trick, right? Is this another attempt just to get pity, to extend the life of Weston so that the demon can keep doing its work? I don't know what the answer there is.
Yeah, I read it as the devil, but as a kind of he will not concede a world in which God wins. It's either here's all the wonder and the glory of you taking my way, or there's just nothing.
That's fair.
You know, and that seems like a very kind of demonic impulse. You know, it's either the utopian humanism or it's just nihilism. This other thing that Ransom represents can't even be an option.
Right. Well, and the contrast to all of that, to all of the speeches Weston gives, is the cycle of speeches at the end. But anything else about Weston before we get to the end? We're in an hour and a half. We probably shouldn't go a whole lot longer.
Well, it is a longer book.
It is. And it's a much better book, I think.
Yeah.
I would, if I were ranking my C.S. Lewis fiction, I would put this certainly ahead of the other two books in the series, and probably ahead of most of the Narnia books. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. Far behind Screwtape Letters, but ahead of a lot of the others. But again, maybe I'm in the minority on that. Any other characters that we want to bring up out of the book before we get to the end?
I liked the dragon. He didn't really do much, but I liked the dragon.
Flew around a little bit.
Yeah. It's kind of fun.
They don't have dogs on Paralandra, but they do have dragons. That was kind of my takeaway.
I might get a dragon if we have those.
you could get a tiger, right? Tiger cubs for...
What? I've been actively resisting bringing up Tiger King up to this point.
Hey, you got to do something with that stimulus check. I mean, you might as well get a tiger.
There you go. Yeah. I'll drop Tiger King in here. I'm actually, if I ever find the time, I'm going to write a blog post about it, about Dante, because especially the last couple episodes of Tiger King kind of remind me of stuff we've said about Dante earlier. Just the war of all against all, just like corrupt people who cannot possibly know or want the good and are strictly in it for themselves just reminds me of so many incidents from the Inferno.
for which cornices of Purgatorio will Tiger King be the bridal?
As object lessons.
No.
Yeah, I don't think anybody in Tiger King is making it to Purgatorio.
yeah, they're really... They're all awful, awful, awful people. But what does that say about us for enjoying watching it, right?
Well, I don't know how much I enjoyed it. I just kind of couldn't stop, and somehow I got Dante out of that. So there's a window into my soul.
Well, in the last chapter of the book, we ascend to the terrestrial paradise, or Venusian paradise, I guess. You can't really use terrestrial there. We meet Mars shows back up, the spirit that governs Mars. We meet the spirit that governs Venus, and then the king and the queen are reunited. They show up with their animal attendants, and they have names. I do not remember what their names are. Is it Tor and something or other? I don't remember. They're just called the king and queen all through the book, and now all of a sudden they have names.
Tor and Tenedril.
Tenedril, there we go.
Yeah, I remember looking at it and thinking, that looks like Tendril and Tentacle, and it sounds like an elf name.
Yeah, I assume there is some kind of linguistic something or other going on, but...
Yeah, in Tolkien's letters he says he thinks Lewis borrowed Tenuvial.
Okay.
Mmm. There you go.
So they meet, and then they have this song or this round of speeches or something where it's unclear who is speaking and who is listening. And I think this is intended to be the counterpoint to all of the temptation along the way. And it's supposed to kind of wrap everything up where, like David, like you said earlier, where you're like, I want Lewis to keep writing. I think this is where he's trying to engage all of that. So questions like, well, if this planet falls, you know, if the temptation succeeds, the crucifixion and resurrection have already happened. So what about that? Like, what is, it's not going to happen again. And isn't that the center point of history? How can this be a center point of history? How can there be another fall? I mean, all of those questions I think are supposed to be dealt with here. Again, I'm not sure how successful Lewis is at that, but I think if Weston is sort of Hegel and Nietzsche and Lovecraft all wrapped in together, I think what's going on here is a sort of appeal to the Christian mystics. There's some Julian of Norwich or John of the Cross going on here, where we're not being given a theological treatise in response. We're being given a vision of sort of a God's eye view of history. Not from the perspective of this linear thing you might find in a philosophy of history, but an all at once emotive submersive experience, right? This dipping us into the feel for God's providential ordaining of everything. At least that's kind of how I read it. Otherwise, it's all just kind of, again, back to nonsense. It seems to be either that or Lewis couldn't think of a way to finish this out. I don't know. It's the part that I was kind of least impressed with in what I think is otherwise a very good book.
I don't know. I love it when they all get around and sing space theology. I'm always interested in the ways that Christians in different cultures and in different times have used language differently to explore the same realities that they're encountering through biblical texts and sacred history and the worship of the church. And one of the things that I loved about Out of the Silent Planet was the ways that Lewis had started to try to imagine what might it be like for someone from another planet to talk about the kinds of things that we recognize in creeds and catechisms.
Right.
And the payoff on this one, I think, is really really interesting. That thought experiment I find to be one that I enjoy. But in terms of narrative logic, it does go on for a really, really long time. And something though makes me think that this might have been Tolkien's favorite part.
I would believe that.
He seems like that kind of guy. He would have been like, yeah. "Oh yeah, this is the good stuff."
I was just going to say, I think I would agree with that, at least as far as its role. The length is a little punishing. I was reading this at 1 a.m. a couple nights ago when all those terrible storms were coming through the South. So I was, you know, checking the radar, and, you know, I was like, oh, I'll finish Perelandra, and it kind of became a slog. Just there for a few minutes at the end. I like it. I feel like it's a little long, but also the moment when Ransom comes out on that, you know, terrace in at the top of the mountains and sees a lake with another coffin next to it is so poignant. I kind of hated to go off into a Venusian Summa Theologia for 20 pages. But it's, again, it is all very good, and he does bring it home at the end.
See, I could have handled it if it were a Summa Theologia, but it's not. It's and I'll show my ignorance of mysticism. It's a whatever it was that Julian of Norwich wrote, or John of the Cross wrote, or I just don't know the names of their books, despite having read some of them.
Revelation of Divine Love and Dark Night of the Soul.
Dark Night of the Soul. There we go. That is one of them that I've read. For example, and I'm not going to read much of this because it goes on for pages, it's talking about dust. Each grain is at the center. The dust is at the center. The worlds are at the center. The beasts are at the center. The ancient peoples are at the center. The race that sinned is there. Tor and Tenedril are there. The gods are there also. Blessed be he. Again, I think that's either kind of reflecting on a God's eye view of creation, how God is sovereign over even each grain of dust and over all peoples and over everything. Or it's just pseudo-hippie spiritual garbage. And I could go either way on that, I think.
I mean, the way that it goes on, where Maladil is, there is the center. He is in every place. Not some of him in one place or some in another, but in each place, the whole Maladil, even in the smallness beyond thought. There is no way out of the center, save into the bent will which casts itself into the nowhere. And you're like, okay. Yeah. But also this idea that, you know, what is the center of reality? The center of reality is God. You know, and where, you know, God's attention and God's intention in everything makes everything crucial, right? You know, every human who has fought with the feeling of insignificance, you know, how could I possibly be significant in this world of billions? And how could this planet be possibly significant in a universe of billions? And, you know, this is the answer. it is the attention of the infinite who is everywhere, intimately engaged with even the tiniest mote of dust. He is the center, and the center is where you are. I love this stuff. I mean, the other thing is, I think he's trying to imagine heaven in a kind of way.
Right.
Because I don't think heaven is going to look like everybody, you know, circling Thomas Aquinas and him saying, some people say this and some people say that. And the students are like, oh, gosh, what do you say, master? And he circles around and gives you his...
Well, in heaven, you just skip to that last one where he says, but I say... Right, because it's heaven, so you don't need all of the other stuff.
Yeah, but what they've done is they've taken the concepts and they've just transitioned it straight into hymnody.
Yeah. Right.
Well, it's like the beasts gathered around the throne in Revelation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's that heady theology that just immediately goes into it straight into praise.
Right.
It doesn't get sort of caught up in a human mind that can become enamored of its complexity and then flatter itself with its ability to appreciate and plumb that complexity and suddenly think that that activity is its end. It is theology that immediately flows over into its proper end of blessed be he.
It's the anti-Hegel, anti-Nietzsche, anti-Lovecraft.
Yeah. Nice. Yes. Yeah. It's knowledge that does not puff up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, that's probably a good place to close things out. Recommended reading from you guys. I don't actually have anything. I don't think there are, other than other Lewis, you know, Screwtape Letters and so on that we've already mentioned, I don't know of any books that are like Perelandra that I would recommend in this context. Do you guys have anything?
I included a brief list. We've mentioned most of them already. A Preface to Paradise Lost, The Allegory of Love, which gets into some of that Stravaric stuff, the essay The Funeral of a Great Myth, which is relevant to Weston's philosophical evolutions. I'll recommend Present Concerns again, because a lot of the early essays in that collection were written about this time. Screwtape Letters. I meant last episode to recommend The Discarded Image, which is his multi-chapter explication of medieval cosmology, which is really relevant to understanding what he's doing. And the off-the-wall one I've got is actually William Peter Blatty's novel, The Exorcist. Stick with me. I've not seen the movie. I don't think I'll be able to. My mom famously chewed through a pen while watching that movie back in the day. But the book is actually quite excellent and really gripping. And the reason I thought of it reading Perelandra is precisely because the devils in The Exorcist, again, are not Mephistopheles types. They are Weston types. They are crude and crass, and nothing is beneath them in the effort to destroy a believer's faith, which I think is the truest aspect of that book.
David, do you have anything for us?
In terms of recommended reading, not just the preface of Paradise Lost, but Paradise Lost itself. Also, Paradise Regained, which is not Genesis 3 redux, but is the temptation desert. So that's similar. It's yet another attempt to kind of get inside of what would it look like for an unfallen being to be tempted. How might you go about doing that? And I found if there's a lot of Paradise Lost echoes in Perelandra, there's also a lot of Paradise Regained echoes. The time that he does this again, C.S. Lewis does this kind of sort of thing again, but less successfully, I think, is The Magician's Nephew.
Right.
Mm.
When there is another garden, another prohibition, and another created world in which evil is introduced. And that there is a fall, and evil does come into that world, but it's humans bringing their evil with them. The world of Narnia becomes infected in a way that the world of Perelandra does not. But that actually leads back to what I said at the beginning. I'm not sure that this is an allegory. Certainly, there are many things that a lot in this book has theological significance and is symbolically tied to those theological significances. But I think what Lewis is doing here in Perelandra and what he's doing in Narnia is not just creating stories that are allegories of Christian theology, but he's trying to imagine what might it look like for there to be another world in which what is theologically true for us here is also true there, but would not be experienced in the way that it is experienced here.
Right.
Narnia is, I think, a less successful attempt at that. Perelandra, I think, is a better, Out of the Silent Planet, but then Perelandra, I think, is a more successful attempt to imagine what would it be like for there to be life on other planets in a universe that God rules, in which Christ's death really was the crucial and climactic event of that the biblical revelation tells us it is. You know, what difference would that make? And I think he's trying to imagine what difference that would make in a science fiction context. If this was just allegory, you could dispose of the literal story once you've gotten the symbol, mm-hmm. in a way. But he's also trying to take seriously at the literal level. This is literally another planet that literally God made and literally. Right, so it's not just Genesis 3 redux with, you know, a happy ending. Not that there's no allegory there, not that there's no symbolism there, But I do think he is trying to do a secondary world fantasy in which the our theology happens to still be true.
No, that's great. All right, I will withdraw my he opens with a lie statement then, and as you were talking about that, it did give me another a book to recommend, and I recommend this with the understanding that what I'm recommending is a book the themes of which I don't agree, but in part I don't agree with it because this guy is intentionally writing to undermine C.S. Lewis. So Philip Pullman's Dark Materials trilogy. Yeah. It is explicitly written to counter the stuff that Lewis is doing in Narnia and the science fiction trilogy. And even more specifically, it's written to say that the fall of man was a good thing and the rebellion against God was a good thing because God's a big meanie. So it's basically a how can we preserve what we gained in the fall? How can we hold on to that? Which it makes it a really interesting book and shows I think a lot of the weaknesses of the worldview that Weston is touting at several points in the book. So it's if you want to read sort of if Weston had written these books, what would it have been? Well, it would have been the Dark Materials stuff. And with that, we should close things out. Thank you guys again for coming on the show. We'll have one more of these down the road. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out our podcast, other podcasts in the network. Get more information about our own show by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or drop us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neil, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I went a walk in that ribbon of highway.